This is the Medicast, January 26th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's episode of the Medicast, episode 153. And we are fast approaching the end of our third year in production and entering our fourth year here in the beginning of February. And I just want to thank all of you listeners that have become part of the Medicast community. You know, there's quite a few of you out there who've pretty much been with me here from day one, it seems like. And I just want to thank all of you for spreading the word and sharing the Medicast with the rest of the EMS community. If you are looking for a way to do that, there's lots of things you can do. At the bottom of every post on the site, there's a share link. You can send a link to somebody by email. You can share it on your Facebook page. Spread the word about the Medicast. Head over and check out the site regularly. I try to put up articles throughout the course of the week in addition to the show notes so that you can find out about what's going on in the EMS community. And so sharing the site is a good way to do that. And I want to thank those of you that do that pretty actively in the EMS forums and other areas in the EMS community. If you are new to the Medicast, a special welcome goes out to you. And you can find the links for the show notes in this episode and every other episode over at the Medicast website. And that is the blog page for the Medicast, medicast.com/blog. If you go to the main page, there's a link to get you there. The main Medicast page, medicast.com, actually has a link to all of the shows we produce here at the Medicast, including the Medicast News and the Nursing Show. But if you want to head directly to the blog, just put a /blog at the end of medicast.com, and it'll take you directly to the main blog pages where I post articles, links, and the show notes for every episode. You'll also find links to the Medicast forums at forums.medicast.com. And I recently put up a link right on the front page of the Medicast forums that'll direct you to the discussion we're having right now on high visibility gear in EMS. It's become a compliance issue as some people are finding that the gear that they've spent a lot of money on for their agencies and their providers is not necessarily meeting the compliance standards from the compliance standards body. And what's being found out is that the manufacturers are not responsible for maintaining that compliance. It's actually up to the buyer to make sure that their people are compliant. So there's some people selling gear out there that's not compliant, even though they might let you think that it is. So if you've gotten gear given to you lately, or you're involved in the purchasing for your agency, you might want to head over and share your comments and thoughts on the Medicast forums. It's free to join and a great community of listeners there, and you can all join and contribute directly there. Go to forums.medicast.com. A lot of you send me emails as well every week here into podmedic@mac.com, and I certainly appreciate that. One of the emails I got recently from listener Justin was wanting to check out if there was a way that I could share the Medicast in some of the social media networking sites. I, of course, have the Medicast forums that are available, but there are other things that you can do to follow what I'm doing, both here on the Medicast and in my other endeavors. I do have a Facebook page, and you can search for me over there under PodMedic will probably get you there, or Medicast, but you can certainly find me over at Facebook. And you can also find pages for the Medicast over at under PodMedic at MySpace, and I also have a Nursing Show link over at MySpace as well. So there's lots of different ways you can follow me. You can follow me under PodMedic most places, especially on Twitter as well. Twitter, if you want to hear what I'm doing throughout the course of the day, you can follow me there. And Justin, thank you for sending in your comments about that. I also got an email in this week from a longtime supporter of the show and contributor here on the MedicCast and the Nursing Show podcast, Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center, and she was checking in to make sure that I got in touch with her and let her know some of the circulation stats for her shows over the last year. And it's really been exciting for me to be able to help out the Maryland Poison Center in getting their important message out about how to use poison centers, about toxicology issues for EMS providers and other medical professionals. And so I want to thank Lisa for her contributions. You can find out more about the Maryland Poison Center, even sign up for their newsletter list. Even if you don't live in the state of Maryland, you can get that newsletter. Go to mdpoison.com and sign up for everything there. And you can also check out some of the shows here having to do with the Maryland Poison Center and some of the toxicology issues for your own information and education. And Lisa was very pleased. We've reached out and gotten her message out to nearly 50,000 listeners over the course of this year, just in those short episodes that she's been able to contribute. And so for her, she's really expanded the reach of her programs. And I think that that's a valuable service that she's been able to provide both to the MedicCast listeners, but to the toxicology marketplace as a whole, as we expand our knowledge of what's out there in the way of education and support for us from our local poison centers. I also heard in from a listener, Joe, who was checking in and wanted to have us do a little bit of back to basics stuff. I had done some things like that over at the nursing show, and he checked in and wanted to find out, well, I'm assuming it's a he, maybe it's a she, J-O, so it might be Joe, for short for Josephine. So I'm sorry if I got your gender wrong, Joe. But anyway, we are going to try to return to basics a little bit here. I think it's a good time for us as we begin the new year here over the last few weeks to return and look at some of our basic skills. So we'll try to get back in and do some more skills-based review, and we'll kick it off today with our tip of the week later on in this episode, and we'll look at a little bit about vital signs and also about trending of vital signs. We'll kind of do a two-part tip here today, so you want to stay tuned for that. Whether you're a long-term provider or somebody who's just brand new as a student, I think you'll find something to take home with you from the things that we cover in the tip this week. So you'll want to make sure you stay tuned for that. And Joe, thank you very much. Whether you're Joe the woman or Joe the man, I apologize. Send me an email and I will give you a mea culpa if I'm wrong. But anyway, want to go ahead and thank you for your email. You know, if you have email comments or would like to touch base with me with a comment or a correction on something I've misspoken in an episode, you'll want to send your comments, questions, and corrections in here to me by email at podmedic@mac.com, or you can call in to the MedicCast voicemail line, and that is 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. Speaking of voicemails, I got a couple of voicemails in this week. Let's start off with a voicemail we got in from Adam.
Hey, Jamie. Adam Dinitz out here in Illinois. Was just listening to your first podcast of 09, and the beginning part you guys were talking about alternative jobs that you can do in EMS. And one of the things I do is I work as the night EMT in a jail. And that is quite different than working in the back of a rig or a private or anything like that. So just thought I'd throw that out for you. And
Adam goes on to leave his email address there at the end, like I ask you to on the voicemail message. But Adam, you're absolutely right. And I really want to hear from others of you out there about alternative ways that you're working as an EMS provider. And, you know, an EMT in a jail is certainly a different healthcare setting. And I'm sure you've seen quite a few things that you wouldn't ordinarily see in the back of a rig, just from the fact that you've got to deal with prisoners. So you've got a different aspect. And I'm certain that scene safety is always on your mind when you're handling people that may be in jail or awaiting trial on a conviction or waiting problems with a violent crime, for instance. So thanks, Adam, for checking in, and I'll look forward to hearing from other listeners on similar topics. Next up is longtime listener Eddie, and Eddie's checking in with something that I wonder if there are other students in EMS feeling the same way.
Hey, Jeremy, it's Eddie from Texas. I just wanted to, like, say how dismayed I am that I'm studying the EMT basic material, and it just seems like at every opportunity for some major life-saving juncture, you're cut off at the knees by, you know, always saying, tone out for ALS, tone out for ALS. And I just think it's so ridiculous that we have basics and they can't even really help patients who are in desperate need at the moment. It's out of hand. I don't know. That was all. Nothing really important. Just wanted to vent. All right. Take care, man.
Hey, Eddie, you know, I've got to say, even though I'm a paramedic and a nurse and all of those, it hasn't been all that long ago, in my memory anyway, that I was an EMTB as well and in school and really wondering what my skills were worth when there were paramedics around virtually every time we went on a call. And so I'm going to address it from that aspect. First off, I'm going to remind every single one of you out there, from EMS students to the paramedic that's been in the street for 30 years, you need to remember that the things that routinely save lives are starting with basic skills. You can give all the drugs in the world. You can defibrillate patients. You can pace patients, cardiovert patients, do trach airways. I don't care. If you don't start with your ABCs, if you don't start with your basic skills like good, solid, adequate, strong chest compressions every time you do CPR, you're never going to revive that patient. And that's a BLS skill. And in most situations, your BLS providers are performing those skills while the paramedics push the drugs. Other things, good, solid BLS airway management. We just talked about this in the neonatal resuscitation episode. Good, solid BLS airway management is really what is usually and most often needed for pediatric and neonatal resuscitation. Good, solid bagging technique is a very important skill. And I'll tell you what, there's a lot of people that are ALS providers that can't use a bag mask to save their lives. They are sloppy at it because they're going to go right in and intubate that patient. So those are skills right there, simple, basic skills that are extremely valuable. I would also point out to you that you're call for ALS because you need to recognize a patient that is an ALS patient, Eddie, but you also need to then move forward and use your BLS skills to support them until you can rendezvous with ALS. So they're just trying to impress upon you the importance of the teamwork approach and the tiered level of life support in this country is that we have basic providers that are in the field and we don't always have ALS providers. So when you need an ALS provider, you need to be able to recognize that this is a cardiac patient or potentially a cardiac patient and rendezvous with ALS. So I look on it differently. And I'm hoping that maybe after you've heard this, you and the others listening, look on it a little bit differently as well. Understand that you still have the ability as a BLS provider in most every jurisdiction in the U.S. I know about to administer or assist a patient with their nitroglycerin. You can consult for additional doses of that drug. So you have the ability to go beyond what the patient's normal instructions are. You have the ability to do good, high-quality CPR and airway management at the BLS level. You have the ability to assess and recognize when a patient needs advanced care. And that is a life-saving skill in and of itself. You have to work within your scope of practice, and you have to learn to do these things. But, you know, a six-year-old kid can be taught some of these skills, but it still takes an adult's understanding and analysis to expand them. Things like use of an EpiPen, understanding how to consult with medical control, understanding how to rendezvous and choose a destination. Maybe you need to make the decision that you're going to go to a different hospital based on the way a patient's presenting. You can make those decisions as a BLS provider, and those decisions are as vital as recognizing an arrhythmia and administering a shock. So I'm just going to leave it at that and hopefully give you some uplift. You know, the other side of it is, Eddie, you're in school to be an EMTB. You can continue and go on to become an ALS provider if you're seeking more of those types of skills. There's nothing to keep you from doing that. But I would urge you to really build and understand that strong foundation as an EMTB that you really need to get things done. So anyone else out there want to comment on this? I'm sure there are many of you that maybe have felt the same way in the past. Let's call into the voicemail line and give Eddie some support as he goes through his EMTB program. Let him know what kind of things you've experienced as an EMTB, as a life-saving member of the EMS community. And let's uplift the rest of our community here and share some of those experiences. So call into the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC, and let's share some of our experiences. I'm going to lead off the news this week looking at a story that I picked up that is coming out of, I believe, North Carolina, looking at a situation where a few years back, a patient that was being transported from a mental institution died later at the hospital. They were in arrest and they were pronounced when they arrived at the hospital. The mental institution is saying that it took 30 minutes for the ambulance to arrive based on the log at the hospital. And it's caused a bit of a pissing match because, of course, EMS is saying there's no way it took us that long to get there. Our average response time is 6 minutes to your location. And so this article just shows the reason for the importance of high-quality documentation. And that documentation includes your dispatch centers, your supervisor logs, and your, of course, patient documentation, especially in a case of a death. But, you know, those are based on good habits. So you should have good documentation for every patient so that when you have something go south, you've got the documentation skills to back it up. But and apparently they've pulled their dispatch logs and their 911 tapes, and they can prove that the call was dispatched not 30 minutes before arrival of EMS, but 6 minutes before arrival of EMS, right on their average response time to that hospital at that facility. And so the patient, they show them calling 911 from the mental institution after they called the code blue, and the patient was worked at the mental institution for only 6 minutes before EMS arrived and took over. So, you know, this just points out why we need to work hard on our solid documentation skills. Next up in the news, a story I think you may have heard in other few locations. I've heard it in a couple of other podcasts discussed, and I think it bears repeating here. A recent study conducted in Dallas County, Texas, where they found that it seems as if there is a delay in cardiac care more likely to happen in women than in men. And this has to do with a look at, they analyzed almost 6,000 EMS calls made during 2004 by people with cardiac symptoms or suspected cardiac symptoms, about half of whom were women. And what they found was that they didn't have a delay in the amount of time it took to necessarily get the patients to the hospital. There was a slight discrepancy between men and women, but it was not enough that made any serious difference. Only a couple of minutes difference between the amount of time between when the call came, the transport time. But there was a delay after EMS crews arrived on the scene to when they began transport. And this is something that I think bears some more looking into, and I expect that other researchers will pick up the ball here and move forward with it. But it points out some things that we need to remind ourselves about when we're examining patients. First of all, there are differences clinically in presentation for a lot of different illnesses between men and women. Abdominal pain can be a lot more and different varied things in women than in men. Cardiac symptoms that are considered classic, such as the pressing chest pain, the feeling like an elephant sitting on your chest, is really more common in men than in women. It happens in women, but you'll hear that description or that type of pain described more often in men. Women are more likely to have non-specific cardiac symptoms, feelings of indigestion, upset stomach, some upper abdominal pain complaints. They may have other peripheral complaints, but you need to have a high index of suspicion for a cardiac problem for anyone that's, say, over the age of, let's say, 40. you should be thinking it might be a cardiac problem if there's anything to do with the thoracic area. I like one 12 lead class I took. They talked about, when do you do a 12 lead? Well, you should be doing a 12 lead on anyone with pain or unusual symptoms between the nose and the navel. Now, that encompasses a lot of stuff, folks. Any respiratory distress, any shortness of breath, any feeling of tightness, any feeling of pain, any kind of numbness or tingling in the extremities between the nose and the navel needs to have a 12 lead done to rule out an involvement of cardiac problems. So we need to have a higher index of suspicion, kind of ramp up our examination of female patients and not always assume that most of our cardiac patients are men. Heart disease happens in women equally, and we should be examining women and thinking chest pain, cardiac care. We should be thinking abdominal pain, cardiac care. It doesn't mean that it couldn't be something else, but you know, there are things going on in the abdominal cavity we can't do much for. But if we are at least examining them, thinking it might be cardiac related, we are prepared to treat a cardiac problem if we identify it early enough. And if there's something else going on in the abdomen, we're not necessarily going to be able to do anything for it anyway, other than maybe manage pain or help them be more comfortable. So these are things we need to think about and be prepared to head in that direction. And it comes from having an idea of the differential diagnosis. So we'll talk about more of those things in other episodes as we cover some of the assessment techniques in future episodes. But it's important for us to look at this. And when you see an article like this, think about a call you've had recently. Think about how you handle assessing female patients who might be in the age ranges or the risk groups for cardiac problems. And then assess these patients carefully and always have a high index of suspicion that there may be a cardiac issue until ruled otherwise. We'll finish up the news with a couple of stories I picked out from the coverage of the inaugural events that occurred this past Tuesday here in the nation's capital, just nearby me here. And both of these articles that I'm going to refer to in the show notes come from emsresponder.com, where they did a really good job of looking at the ramped up EMS first responder response to the anticipated crowds and what kind of things they handled. And you start looking at how the DC EMS and fire department kind of dealt with things, and they have certainly fallen under some adverse scrutiny from me in the past based on some of their recent issues. But I want to give them a heads up and a kudos to them for the way they seem to have handled situations handling the inauguration. They were, of course, had their own people present, but reached out quickly to area first responders. Other areas of the DC government reached out to other cities in the country to bring in their specialists. So they had people on the metro from other nation cities, subway systems to handle covering security and response. They also came in, and of course, in the EMS crews, they had a lot of EMS crews running around. They had six special EMS task forces that were spread out across the nation's capital between 4 a.m. and 4 p.m. They had first aid stations on the mall treating people that had medical problems, and those specific first aid stations, according to one article, treated almost 500 people, transporting 31. Senator Ted Kennedy had a seizure during a luncheon and had to be taken to the hospital. Temperatures actually went down and it became very cold. The numerous tents set up around the area to provide heat for visitors were present, and other visitors flagged down local EMS crews for assistance. In all, they handled nearly 1,200 responses in that 12-hour period, just with the amazing numbers of people that came in there. One of the particular responses and links that I provide you actually has a great video segment that looks at the EMS response where they brought people. And so I urge you to check that out as well, because there was just a ton of details. And anyone that hasn't gone back and listened to that episode, I'd urge you to head back and listen to the episode from November's EMS Medicast Live, where we talked about the challenges that people face dealing with huge influxes of crowds. And we talked to our friend Craig Corey from North Carolina, and also with some representatives from his local EMS agency. Dr. Corey came in and talked about how they handle a major NASCAR event that comes in and doubles the county's population in a single weekend, and how they have to deal with that. So you can imagine how much this can really affect a city's ability to respond. But it seems like things went very smoothly and that there were no major glitches as I look back. So I keep the DC EMS under scrutiny. They've had a lot of challenges, and I think they've had some issues getting those challenges fixed. But in this case, it seems like they got their ducks in a row appropriately, as I would expect from a major metropolitan service, and they have gotten themselves geared up appropriately for the inaugural response. So I would urge you to read these articles and think about even smaller events that happen in your communities, whether it's a local fair, a special weekend event, perhaps there's some kind of festival that happens regularly in a community in your region. Again, all of these lessons can be adapted to smaller events as well. You'll also find links to the Medicast forums at forums.medicast.com. And I recently put up a link right on the front page of the Medicast forums that'll direct you to the discussion we're having right now on high visibility gear in EMS. It's become a compliance issue, as some people are finding that the gear that they've spent a lot of money on for their agencies and their providers is not necessarily meeting the compliance standards from the compliance. So if you've gotten gear given to you lately, or you're involved in the purchasing for your agency, you might want to head over and share your comments and thoughts on the Medicast forums. It's free to join, and a great community of listeners there, and you can all join and contribute directly there. Go to forums.medicast.com. A lot of you send me emails as well every week here into podmedic@mac.com, and I certainly appreciate that. One of the emails I got recently from listener Justin was wanting to check out if there was a way that I could share the MedicCast in some of the social media networking sites. I, of course, have the MedicCast forums that are available, but there are other things that you can do to follow what I'm doing, both here on the MedicCast and in my other endeavors. I do have a Facebook page, and you can search for me over there under PodMedic will probably get you there, or MedicCast, but you can certainly find me over at Facebook. And you can also find pages for the MedicCast over at under PodMedic at MySpace, and I also have a nursing show link over at MySpace as well. So there's lots of different ways you can follow me. You can follow me under PodMedic most places, especially on Twitter as well. Twitter, if you want to hear what I'm doing throughout the course of the day, you can follow me there. And Justin, thank you for sending in your comments about that. Next up is blood pressure. And blood pressure is one of those skills that is one of the things we learn very quickly, I think. It's not very difficult to learn to take a blood pressure, but there's a couple of things we need to keep in mind about blood pressures. We need to use the appropriately sized cuff for the patient. If we use a cuff that is too small, we're going to get blood pressure readings that are higher than they would normally be. If we use a cuff that's too large for the patient, we'll get a lower blood pressure than we actually have. So we need to really make sure the cuffs are sized appropriately. The width of the cuff is generally how that's done, and you want to make sure that the cuff is at its widest point about 35 to 40% of the length of the upper arm. And that's pretty much, you know, it comes in generally small, medium, and large sizes, and then there are pediatric sizes for patients below that. And there are extra large sizes and thigh cuffs to take blood pressures on extremely large patients. Once you've got the appropriate sized cuff, you want to make sure that you have a good fit, that the Velcro is attaching securely, and that it's tight or snug against the arm. It doesn't have to be tight, but you don't want it sliding down the arm. So you want it attached snugly enough to hold it in place while you get the bladder out and get the gauge in a position where you can read it. You'll then want to go ahead and inflate your gauge. You want to auscultate using your stethoscope at the anticubital fossa, listening for the brachial artery there. And you'll want to listen. Sometimes if you have trouble hearing the blood pressure, hearing the thump of the blood moving through as the cuff is released slowly, you want to slide. I always try to move my stethoscope head laterally back and forth across the inside of the arm there over the anticubital fossa. Generally, I find that towards the midline of the body tends to give me a better reading sometimes when I have patients that I'm not hearing very well. If you cannot get a good blood pressure, then you're going to go ahead and do it again, but try to palpate a radial pulse while you're taking it. And the way this works is that you're only going to be able to get a bipalpation reading, and that reading is only going to be a general reading of the systolic blood pressure, the higher reading, but you can go ahead and use that method as well. I'm not going to go into how to take the vital signs. That's a whole nother topic here, but certainly something you can keep track of and learn how to do and fall back on. You're going to go ahead and record your blood pressures appropriately. You're going to make sure that you've used the right cuff and make sure that all that's squared away. Normal blood pressure readings are patients, anyone with a systolic blood pressure of less than 120 and a diastolic blood pressure of less than 80. And generally, that's generally the systolic range is 90 to 120. Some places might say 100 to 120 for normal range. Anything above 120 systolic, anything above 80 diastolic is starting to be considered pre-hypertensive. And when you get up above 140 systolic, you're talking about patients that are experiencing hypertension.
Again, hypotension, generally patients, when they get down below 90 systolic, we start being concerned about patients being hypotensive. And this can all be relative. So you have to understand a little bit more about the patient's the way the patients are medicated and the patient's own medical history. Always ask a patient what their normal blood pressure is. A lot of people take their blood pressures on a regular basis, especially elderly patients, and they are aware of where their normal range is. So they can tell you that the number you got is in the ballpark. This will give you an idea, if the patient knows this, of whether or not they're experiencing a shock. Can be experiencing anxiety if their blood pressure is higher than expected or lower than expected. So it's something to always ask.
I also got an email in this week from a longtime supporter of the show and contributor here on the MedicCast and the Nursing Show podcast, Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. And she was checking in to make sure that I got in touch with her and let her know some of the circulation stats for her shows over the last year. And it's really been exciting for me to be able to help out the Maryland Poison Center in getting their important message out about how to use poison centers, about toxicology issues for EMS providers and other medical professionals. And so I want to thank Lisa for her contributions. You can find out more about the Maryland Poison Center, even sign up for their newsletter list. Even if you don't live in the state of Maryland, you can get that newsletter. Go to mdpoison.com and sign up for everything there. And you can also check out some of the shows here having to do with the Maryland Poison Center and some of the toxicology issues for your own information and education. Speaking of voicemails, I got a couple of voicemails in this week. Let's start off with a voicemail we got in from Adam. Next up is longtime listener Eddie, and Eddie's checking in with something that I wonder if there are other students in EMS feeling the same way. And that's going to wrap up another episode here of The MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week and remind you that there will be links to everything we've discussed in this episode at the MedicCast website on the blog. And that's at www.mediccast.com/blog, or you can just go to mediccast.com and you'll click on the show notes page link right there for the MedicCast. You'll want to check out the podcast category, and that'll give you this episode most recently, if you're listening to this as it's coming out, or you can go back in time and look at previous episodes, show notes entries, as well as all of the links that I provide for you. It's important for you to take what I tell you in general knowledge and apply it to your own protocols and your own scope of practice. So please use the information I provide you, but you have to take it and apply it to what you do, and that's your job. I can't know everybody's protocols or everybody's baseline vital ranges, so I give you a ballpark, but yours may be slightly different, and you need to know what your instructors, what your testing centers, what your training officers are expecting from you when you come in to do some kind of a review or a test or an evaluation. It was great getting the two voicemails in, so I want to remind all of you that you can get back in touch with me both by email and voicemail, but I'll give the voicemail number first because I really like getting voicemail calls. 941-306-3342. Put that in your cell phones. Hang on to it. When you're listening to the show, call me if you have a question or a concern or a complaint or whatever, and you can get a hold of me at that number. 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC. And if you need to get me by email, as always, podmedic@mac.com. All right, time to wrap up here with a piece from a longtime songwriter that's I've brought on this show in the past, Ingrid Michaelson, a favorite of mine, a favorite of my daughter's too, actually. And so they're always asking me to play her music. But she's got her music over at the PodSafe Music Network, making it available for you. So you always want to support those artists that are getting out there and providing entertainment for your podcast. So head over and check out her link in the show notes. And this is Ingrid Michaelson with The Way I Am. I hope you enjoy it. In the meantime, I will be getting ready for next week's show here soon. And I want to remind all of you to remember, folks, scene safety and BSI. To all